And welcome to the Circle of Respect Book Club series. We're joined today by author Sudhir Venkatesh, author of the New York Times bestseller Gang Leader for a Day, A Rogue Sociologist Takes to the Streets. Sudhir, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's great to speak with you. Thank you.
So why don't we just jump right in? This book is really, truly fascinating. The topic of what actually goes on within a gang is something that I know a lot of people, myself included, are extremely interested in learning about. Can you briefly describe how you first got involved studying this subject and what motivated you to write this book?
Sure. I was a graduate student at the University of Chicago, and I had an interest in understanding the lives of different young people growing up in different kinds of neighborhoods, some poor neighborhoods, suburban neighborhoods, and so on. And I accidentally, as the book starts out, walked into a housing development, a project, and met this street gang, and slowly started to realize that I probably shouldn't be there. And it ended up being okay. They kept me there for a while, and I got to talk and meet with some of the leaders. And what I was able to do that was really helpful to me was to get inside the lives of some pretty troubled youth and even young adults. And that was really important for me because up till that point, it had been really hard for people to meet those kinds of folks firsthand and get a sense for what they were feeling, what they were doing, so that we could compare their experiences with others. And eventually I moved in with some of them and started living with their families to get a firsthand look at what life was like for street gang members and their communities.
Oh, so what motivated you to write the book after you spent the time there?
Well, I had been writing mostly scholarly articles and for a very small group of sociologists, but I realized that most people, when they look at these communities, they probably see something that's like chaos and that's something that's really out of control. But I saw something different. I saw a really complicated place where the street gang, where the troubled young people were part of a web of activity, and there was good and bad. And in fact, some of the most fascinating things for me that made me want to write this book was just the contrast. If you turn on the TV, if you turn on CNN or read the paper, you'll see shootings and homicides and drug dealing. But rarely do you find out what happens afterwards. What happens after a shooting? Well, how do they try to control the drug dealing? I saw these amazing stories of people who were trying to keep things together, school teachers, parents, clergy, social workers. And I really wanted to get those stories out because otherwise you were going to get a very one-sided portrait of what the life in the inner city was like.
Yeah, that's actually a great segue into our next question. The media tells us a lot of different things about gangs, you know, movies, TVs, magazines. They all seem to portray gangs in a different light and have something different to say. But you got the chance to actually witness firsthand what gang culture is about and how they operate. A constant theme throughout your entire book is the idea that gang members either respected JT's authority or they feared it. Can you discuss a little bit about the ways in which respect and fear played a role within the gang and the surrounding community?
There's a typical view of street gangs, which is something like somebody from Mars coming into a community, and everyone in the community is trying to get rid of this alien. But a lot of these gang members are kids who are of parents, their nephews, their school children. They're not someone who people don't see every day in many different ways, and so. It's not so easy as just kicking people out of your community who are committing crimes. And when the street gang starts to act in a way that they bring resources into poor communities, then it gets even more complicated because if there are no foundations, if the government isn't giving money for kids programs, sometimes the gang leader becomes a philanthropist. Sometimes they start giving money to the Boys and Girls Club or to parents for an after-school program. So it can turn surreal pretty quick. And the reason that's important is that if they start giving money, they want respect. And they want to be recognized for being part of that community. So residents are in a really difficult situation in which they're struggling to both limit the crime and get rid of gang activity, but on the same hand, dealing with these young adults who want to be recognized. And some of the residents want to recognize them because they know that they can't just kick them out and they want to turn their lives around. So on the one hand, the street gang members that are doing this are doing this for respect as well as for money. I'm not legitimizing what they're doing, but I think respect and the need to grow up and feel like you're somewhat legitimate in the community is a huge driving motivation in what they're doing.
That's a great point. I think that teens in general or youth in general often feel that way, that they want to be recognized for something. So it's, you know, a way that we can connect, you know, youth that are in gangs to youth that aren't. So it's something that we all kind of share in common. But, you know, gangs and the projects are typically known to be fairly dangerous. While the reader may not really get the impression that you were scared, there were a few times throughout the book that you mentioned that the residents of the Robert Taylor homes or the members of the Black Kings were angry with you. What compelled you to keep going back, even if it may not have been the safest idea?
There were several times in my research where I felt like I might have made a mistake, or I might have betrayed someone's confidence, or I was just in the middle of a, you know, a drive-by shooting or an episode of violence, and I really wanted to get out of there. I think partly I stayed because I was very young when I was doing this work, probably a little naive and didn't know what I should be doing. I think the other reason is that this is a community, like many inner-city communities, in which people are subjected to a lot of outsiders coming in and asking all sorts of questions, like police officers and journalists and social workers and you know, it just goes on down the line. These folks usually come in, ask their questions, and then leave. I wanted to be doing things a little differently. I wanted folks to see that I was not interested in just getting something from them in a one-shot interview and then never seeing them again. And so that's why I stayed on people's couches. I moved into apartments. I wanted people to feel like they could open up to me in a way that maybe they didn't feel like they could with others. And to do that, that meant I had to keep coming back. And I think that, that helped me. And even though I made some mistakes along the way, and I think I kept going back and telling folks, hey, I'm sorry if I did this, I didn't mean to, or I just, you know, wanted them to understand that I was fallible and that I was interested in some deeper story, and I think that really helped at the end of the day.
Absolutely. You know, it always helps to become more of a member of a community in any situation. But we hear a lot about how in poverty-stricken areas that residents tend to come together and build their own community. Many residents, you know, may pull together for food, rent, daycare, among other things, and really do pull together like one big family. In the beginning of your book, I noticed that it seemed as if everyone really worked together to protect one another, but towards the end, you explain how every person was desperate to secure their own welfare, quite possibly at the expense of their neighbor. Can you describe some of the differences you noticed as this shift occurred?
The book ends just as a very interesting transformation in the community got underway, and that is that the residents of a housing development that had been there for 40 years, the housing development was about to be torn down. So they had, for 40 years, created all of these relationships and ties and really interesting ways of sharing, like you were saying, with food and daycare, et cetera. Well, all of a sudden, the housing authority says, your building is coming down, and we don't have resources to move everyone at once. And so there's a scramble, and people start looking out for themselves. And friends start to become competitors, and people who really were very used to surviving by sharing now started to say, you know what, I have to look out for myself and I got to get out of here. And it created a really awful situation in which people could have continued to help one another make a transition into a better community, but instead they were forced to look out for their own families. And it probably didn't have to go that way, but that's what happened in Chicago, as in many other cities. And you know what? I think that's in a small way, generally what life is like in poverty, which is that when resources are not there in the way that they should be for all families, people are forced to be friends with somebody, and at the very next day, they could be competing with that person for a resource. So ties and alliances and friendships, they don't last very long often.
Yeah, this book in general just touches a lot of different issues, poverty, gang life, drugs, power authority, relationships, just to name a few of the many issues that it touches. But Before we finish up, I just want to know what your hope was for this book and what you wanted people to gain from reading your book.
Well, I think there were two things that I hoped. I really do hope that people, when they get through the book, can say that even in the most troubled circumstances, there are people that are doing good and there are people that are wanting to better their community, and that I should be careful if I'm looking at a poor community not to judge everyone, just as they probably wouldn't want to be judged. I think the second thing is probably the next step after that realization. If you think about today, so much of how we help each other is facilitated by technology. You know, we can send money to places thousands and thousands of miles away in another continent over oceans to somebody who might need a malaria net or somebody who might need a few dollars to start a business, and that's all great. I wanted to give people a different feeling. I wanted to make them think that, you know what, I could probably still go next door. I could probably still go down the street to maybe a low-income community and volunteer or teach literacy or work in a soup kitchen, that there's still the need for me at home. And that's a lofty goal. I'm not sure everyone's going to do that after reading the book, but just as a reminder that that next to us and around us are still places of great need.
Oh, that's really moving. But I really hope that everyone goes out there and picks up this book to read. Like I said earlier, this book really, truly is really fascinating. I personally had a hard time putting it down. Oftentimes we believe everything we hear, what the TV tells us or what we see in movies, but rarely do we get a chance to hear or see the real story of what's really going on. And your book does exactly that. It tells us about the hardships of those living in poverty, how a gang operates and functions, and most importantly, the real feelings of real people. So if you haven't picked up Sudhir's book, Gang Leader for a Day, please do. To learn more about Sudhir and his book, visit www.circleofrespect.org to check it out. We have the book featured as our August feature issue of the Circle of Respect Book Club. Sudhir, thanks so much for joining us today. It was wonderful speaking with you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.